Hello and welcome to Season 12, Episode 24 of the Ubuntu Podcast. Today we are going to be having a chat with Kyle from Canonical about robots and stuff. We'll also have some command line love and we will go over your feedback. And joining me this week, it's just Alan again. Oh well.
Thanks.
I love you really, Alan.
Oh, thanks.
So what have you been up to?
So I obsessively collect junk and...
ThinkPads.
Yep. Classic arcade games, all kinds of stuff. And I thought it was about time I catalogued this stuff. I was sat in a nerd Telegram channel and someone linked to a page because someone asked a question about, oh, what spec is that PC or something? And he linked to a page which was a wiki page, his own personal wiki, that listed all of his hardware, like every single machine and the detailed specs of everything. I think possibly for, you know, documentation purposes, but also so that if anyone else is thinking of buying that laptop, they know that it works with Linux because he's written it up, right? It's not in some, it's not a hardware compatibility database. It's, you know, just a nice record. And I thought, huh, that's cool. So I started creating such a page on my own personal wiki, which I have. And it's quite fun. I started digging out all my ThinkPads and booting them up to find out what CPU is inside them and how much RAM they've got and all that kind of stuff, just to have a catalogue of it. Because people often ask me, you know, what model of ThinkPad have you got? And I can now point them at a web page and
say, so, well, all of them.
All of these ThinkPads. So, yeah, that was kind of, it was kind of nice to boot each one of them up as well. And one of them had Haiku on it, and I didn't know how to drive Haiku to find out what processor the computer has in it. So I ended up wiping Haiku off and putting Bunsen Labs on it.
What's Bunsen Labs?
It's like the spiritual successor to Crunch Bang Linux that Phil Neubrauer created all those years ago. It's like the spiritual successor. If you install it, you wouldn't notice much difference.
Right, oh, okay.
It's the same kind of thing. But yeah, that allowed me to look at all the details of how much RAM and CPU. And I learned a command. It's not worthy of command line love, but I learned a command. And it was lscpu.
Ah, I didn't know about that.
No, neither did I. I knew lsblock and lspci and lsusb, but I didn't know lscpu. And all it does is print pretty much what you see in, if you cat proc CPU info, but a little bit more human readable.
Excellent. So have you got much more hardware to catalog or are you done?
Oh gosh, yes. So I've done most of the laptops. I've got three more, maybe more laptops to do than some others, but I've also started cataloging my old arcade games as well.
So have you had to go up in the loft and dig things out?
Yes, I have. I only got one of them out, but I think I'm going to dig them all out. But this has triggered me to actually, I think I'm going to start testing them and cleaning them up and making sure they're in a fit state. And then I'm going to package them back up in boxes and put them back in the loft.
Never to be seen again.
Yes. Well, they're only appreciating in a value all the while that I'm not, you know, mucking about with them and they're, you know, they're in storage.
So do you have something that you can plug them into to test that they work?
Yes. I have a thing called a super gun, which is a, I don't know who came up with the term super gun, but it's basically a power supply, a circuit board that can connect to the edge connector of the arcade card and a couple of joystick ports that you can plug Sega Mega Drive controllers into and compatible.
Or Amiga controllers, yes.
Yes, that kind of thing. And it outputs to SCART, so you can plug that into a telly.
Oh, okay, right, cool.
So it's pretty cool. There are people who make them. You can buy them on eBay. They're not complicated things. It's just a small circuit to, you know, route the button presses from the joysticks to the right pins on the jammer connector and provide power and get the display out. Yeah, there's not a lot to them.
Right, and now we're joined by Kyle Fazzari from Canonical. Hi, Kyle.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Now, Kyle, it says here you are senior engineer, brackets, robotics. That sounds really cool.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
So what do Canonical do with robotics, and what's your job as senior engineer involving?
That's a great question. It's actually a relatively new effort, and so there's a reason most people aren't familiar with this. I actually started here on the Ubuntu phone project, like a lot of us. But before my time at Canonical, I was a roboticist. After the Ubuntu phone project, I switched to Snapcraft and Snapd, and I worked on core features there, but I also took ownership of the robotics features there, building snaps for various versions of the robot operating system, which I'll talk about in a sec.
Wow, I didn't know there was a robot operating system.
I know, right?
It's not quite an operating system. It's more of a middleware, but yeah, well, it's very interesting. So I started doing that, and we started getting more and more customers that were making robots using Ubuntu, using snaps. And so I started consulting with them as well. And we realized, you know, we should have a team working on this. We also realized that there were features we wanted to work on upstream ROS with. And so we recently formed a team that was dedicated to doing this. And as a senior engineer, that's the effort I'm leading from a technical level.
So when people think of robots, like, they might think of tiny little things on their desk, or they might think of like a Roomba or Robot Wars.
I'm thinking of Isaac Asimov, androids with computer brains.
I'm thinking Will Smith, obviously.
Yeah, the humanoid robots, it depends on who you're talking to. If they're technical people, they'll think about a Roomba maybe, but oftentimes less technical people just think about androids, you know, humanoid robots. And those are actually pretty rare. Like, there's so many problems to solve in making a humanoid robot. They exist. PAL makes some, but they are quite rare.
So, you know, we see sometimes at places like CES and MWC, we see like companies trotting out robotics thing. What kind of robots are we talking about here then? If not the Roomba, and if not the animatronic
Commander Data,
yes, what kind of robots are we talking about?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, let's start with trying to define what a robot is, right? Because if you ask three different people what is a robot, you're going to get three different answers. I generally define them as they're hardware, physical devices, right, that take input from sensors and make decisions based on them, and that's really as specific as I try to get. And even there are exceptions, right?
Mm-hmm.
But as far as what are the robots we care about, right? There's a huge variety. There are drones, right? Those are pretty popular these days. There are these delivery robots. You'll see some of those, right?
But when you say drones, like, the immediate thought is a quadcopter style drone, but it doesn't have to be that, does it?
No, it doesn't. There's no hardware restrictions at all. As long as it's something that is taking input and making decisions, right? That's the thing.
So whether you attach wings, wheels, or put a hull on it and put it in the sea, it doesn't really matter. It's still a robot.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
Okay. So in terms of Ubuntu's role in all of this, what's the actual software that Ubuntu is enabling on these devices?
So there are a couple of things that we're doing in Ubuntu. First of all, the Ubuntu robotics team maintains, like I was doing, maintains the robotics features in Snapcraft. And so there is definitely a good snap tilt there. And another one is consulting, right? As customers come to us wanting to partner making robots, that's something that my team handles as well. We get, you know, a team of roboticists, that makes sense. Beyond that, though, we're actually working in upstream ROS 2. And to describe that, let me back up a little bit and describe what ROS itself is. So ROS, the robot operating system, it's, like I mentioned, not actually an operating system. It's middleware. It's a set of libraries and tools, open source, that make creating a robot easier than it would be otherwise. You know, when you're making a robot, there are a lot of problems you need to solve. Interacting with various pieces of hardware, getting data out of the sensors, fusing it in some way, doing something with it. ROS solves a lot of these problems by providing both a communications layer and an architecture such that each of these functions can be handled by a standalone process, so they don't really have a hard requirement on another one. If they crash, they don't take the whole thing down, you know? And many of these are already written in open source. So, like, you know, need a driver for this Ethernet camera? Well, I bet it's already written. You know, it's the open source story, right? Driver for a robotic arm, it's already there. Need an entire stack of software that, if you feed it properly, allows your robot to autonomously navigate and avoid obstacles? That exists. So that's what ROS is. Now, there are two different versions of ROS. There's ROS 1 and ROS 2. ROS 1 was born out of academia. It values the flexibility there above all else, right? And that's a valid goal, noble goal. It allows a lot of research papers to be written really quickly, right? Because you can switch out hardware and experiment with different things. And that's really what robotics is all about. But as a result of that, a number of things that become important as one approaches production were kind of sacrificed, like real-time support, security. Those things were never really considered and ended up being designed out.
So when you say like real-time support, are you talking about like mission-critical systems or just something that needs to react quickly?
Well, so yeah, it's a good question. I'm talking about mission-critical. Like think about an autonomous car, right? Mm-hmm. You need to have determinism. When I press the brake or when I press the e-stop, this thing needs to respond within X. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
Now, when I say real-time, it's often misunderstood. People often think of real-time as something that just operates faster somehow magically. Colin King, he's a huge performance guy in the kernel team. He wrote a white paper on real-time kernels for network virtualization, some telco thing, but it's actually super applicable to robotics. He compared the performance you get from the real-time kernel to the low-latency kernel, for example. And you actually get better performance out of the low-latency kernel because it's not spending all its time switching context. You're more power efficient. You get more done. Really, what you get from real time is determinism at the cost of several things.
You also mentioned security was something that was maybe overlooked in ROS. Is that, they just didn't audit for security or they didn't use best practices or both or?
Kind of both. Honestly, it was a conscious decision. They said academia doesn't really care about security. Therefore, we don't either. We don't know anything about security. This just isn't one of our goals, right?
Right.
When you're doing research, it's not important.
Right. Exactly. And as a result, they built something that was really hard to lock down without breaking API and just breaking everyone who's using it, right? That's where ROS 2 comes in. ROS 1 has existed for a surprising amount of time, and it's really well used. But they have these issues when it comes time to production, right? And so they're making ROS 2 from scratch, taking what they learned from ROS 1. And trying to improve upon these shortcomings. Security is one of them. Now, security is particularly important to us, right? This is something we've really been driving once we realized how silly the whole IoT wave was, right? That whole thing's been taking off and it's really sad. Low-margin devices, no one has any incentive to keep them up to date, keep them secure, right? Manufacturers want to drive costs down. Users don't even think of a thermostat as a computer. So sure, they're going to connect it to the internet, you know, it's like, and not update it. No one thinks about these things, right? And that's one of the reasons we made Snaps in Ubuntu Core. Like if security and maintenance was a solved problem and it was easy to make a device that had these problems solved, why wouldn't manufacturers use them, right? And if we accomplish that, then we make the whole ecosystem better for everybody.
You've mentioned Snaps a few times, and I know you said you worked on the Snapcraft side of the robotics side. Is that for people who want to develop, let's say, I don't know, a computer vision thing, they can make it as a snap that people could put on their robot? Is that the goal of that part of?
Not really. It's more about manufacturers, right? I make a robot and I ship it. Is it secure? Probably not, unless I base it on something that solves that problem or I have security engineers working on that aspect. And B, what's my update story? As soon as I sell these devices, how do I keep them up to date? Well, those are the problems that Snap solve. So from a robotics perspective, I'm really looking at it from someone who's making these things, not making individual components necessarily, but as a manufacturer that's making robots and wants to keep it secure and up to date without having to resolve all of those problems.
And all the time, you know, whenever you're talking about robots, I see blog posts with like cute little things driving around your lounge and small desk-bound robots. But we need to think bigger. We're talking like machines that build cars and that kind of thing.
Yes, certainly, exactly. Or before my time here as a roboticist, I worked on an unmanned Humvee, right? That all used ROS.
Really?
Yeah.
That sounds cool.
I can't talk about that too much, but okay. But that, yeah, I mean, to give you an idea of the size of some of these things, yeah, certainly.
Right.
Based on what we've done with Snaps at Ubuntu Core, right, we have a secure OS, we have a secure packaging method, a secure update method, but that's a little naive to think that that's all that's needed, right? If it's running software that has holes in it, that the picture is incomplete. And so that's where we're actually joining the ROS2 effort. So we've joined the ROS2 Technical Steering Committee, where we're working on the security features. We want to make sure that those are all baked in properly from the beginning, instead of trying to bolt them on after the fact, like we tried to, you know, tried to do with ROS1 and it didn't work out. And so that's where we're contributing upstream to ROS2, is making sure that security is both supported and is easy to use.
And so who else maintains ROS? You said it like came out of a, you know, research and academia. Who maintains it now? Is it the customers that use it, the people who implement it, or is there like a ROS organization?
There's a company called Open Robotics that so it's what used to be Willow Garage. Open Robotics is now the maintainers of ROS, both ROS 1 and ROS 2.
And there's a whole bunch of sponsors who finance this thing. I noticed when I look at the ROS discourse, it lists a whole bunch of sponsors, including Ubuntu, but it's got other people like Microsoft and iRobot and Amazon and a whole bunch of other people. Are these people who like sponsor the development of ROS?
Some. So for example, Amazon is also on the steering committee with us. They also actually develop pieces of ROS. They're working on tooling and security. We work with them on security as well. They have a RoboMaker team. But I think what you're probably looking at is the ROSCon sponsors. They sponsor the conference. And so like Ubuntu, we sponsor that. And along with the other companies you mentioned as well.
What happens at a ROSCon? Is it like any, you know, free software conference, a bunch of talks and a bunch of exhibitors, that kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly.
Is it big? I mean, you've mentioned that it's been around a long time, but I'm sure a ton of our listeners won't have heard of it other than, you know, blog posts we've linked to on the Ubuntu blog, probably. I'm sure this is the first time a lot of people have heard of ROS and ROS2. And like, it feels like it's big, but people don't know about it.
Robotics is kind of niche, right? But yeah, the conference sells out every year. It's about, they vary between, it depends on their venue, but you know, 500, 600 people.
Oh, wow.
It's a decent size, and there are a lot of vendors with cool robots there showing things off. And you know, what's interesting, if any of your listeners are, you know, in university or something, everybody who uses ROS, it's a joke at ROSCon, because every presentation you get doesn't end with any questions. It ends with, "We're hiring."
So what's the forward-looking game plan for Ubuntu? Is it to be, you know, the platform? If you're using ROS, you're using Ubuntu, you know, and that, yeah, that's the end of the story. Is anyone doing anything with ROS on anything that's not Ubuntu? Do people use like, you know, roll your own distro or something else? Or is it just everyone already uses Ubuntu?
So for the most part, people use Ubuntu. Part of the reason for that is that Open Robotics maintains a Debian repo that works with Ubuntu, right? But if you're going to use Arch or it's not Open Embedded, but any of those other tool chains, you end up having to build everything yourself. And so for the most part, it's the easiest.
Or like Yocto or something like that.
Yeah, Yocto. That's what I was looking for. Thank you. There are people that do it, but for the most part, people use Ubuntu, which is one of the reasons we care so much about ROS, right? We want to make sure that everyone who uses Ubuntu gets the best experience possible.
See, I find this fascinating that like we're constantly, you know, hearing, the Linux desktop is dying and it's all moving to the cloud and it's only cloud is where people are doing stuff. But then there's these devices, you know, squirreled away in a factory or scuttling around delivering products or, you know, whatever they might be.
Warehouses is huge. Yeah.
Really?
That's where I see most robots these days, are warehouse robots. Think Amazon type. Yeah.
Wow.
It's fantastic.
Yeah. So if people are interested in finding more about ROS in general, but also more about your work and what Canonical's doing in this area, where can people go to find out more information?
So we have an Ubuntu blog. One of the categories there is robotics. And you can actually subscribe to the newsletter. One of the checkboxes is robotics. So every time we post something, you'll get an email about it. There's a contact us page at the bottom of every or a link rather, at the bottom of every blog that'll take you to a little form you can fill out if you want to partner with us or contract in some sort of consulting fashion. We do all that type of stuff.
Cool. And is there a role for community members as well who want to get involved in contributing to this sort of stuff?
Totally. There are two IRC channels. Actually, let's just say one. in Freenode, there's the Ross IRC channel. We're all there. I was going to say there's also the Ubuntu Robotics channel. But honestly, if you're talking to us about robotics, you're probably talking to us about Ross. You can hop in the Ross channel and we're all there.
Cool.
And yeah, all this stuff is open source. I mean, we'd love to work with any community members.
Awesome. Well, Kyle, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you love the command line as much as we do, send us a command that will blow our minds, and we might even mention it on the show. Send your command line love to show@ubuntupodcast.org.
And this week's command line love was mentioned in our Telegram channel, which is at ubuntupodcast.org/telegram. I think it was mentioned by Roger Light. And it is called Date Fudge.
Okay.
So what this command does is you run date fudge and a date and then another command, and that command will run as though it's a different system time. So you can say date fudge yesterday and then a command, and it will run as though the system time is set to yesterday.
That sounds super cool and groovy. Why on earth would you want to do that?
Well, one of the examples that was given in the conversation where it was brought up was if you want to generate an expired security certificate. So if you're testing how a system handles expired certificates, normally when you generate a certificate, it generates it from now until whenever it expires. But if you want to generate it 3 years ago, so it's already expired, you can use it for this.
Wonder if you could test this for Y2K38 compliance by date fudging to the year 2039 and running commands.
Yes, and see if everything explodes and all the planes fall out of the sky.
That's brilliant. I love that. I just love the name more than anything.
Yeah, it's good. I searched for it and I found some interesting confectionery companies selling date fudge.
Ooh.
But we'll have a link to the man page in our show notes.
That's way more boring than the date fudge, but okay.
We love getting your feedback. If you've got a comment about something you hear on the show, why don't you drop us an email on show@ubuntupodcast.org.
And now it's time for all of your wonderful feedback. And Jason Murtha emailed us to show@ubuntupodcast.org.
You asked for why folks would use Enlightenment. And while I confess I'm not using it now, it always was and remains my favourite desktop shell. Put briefly, it looks decently sharp, offers themes that don't waste a lot of space, has very good performance and low resource usage, and is more customizable than DEs like GNOME. As for actual features, it has a few great things going for it, namely real working focus follows mouse, the keyboard quick launcher, everything is very good. I think everything in quotes is actually what the quick launcher is called. Easy to configure keyboard shortcuts for manipulating the window without having to grab the window edge. Good handling of multiple and virtual desktops. When using it, I did always miss the HUD and fully baked expose mode. Interesting. Real working focus follow mouse. I find that interesting because I use focus follows mouse on everything, on Mate, KDE, and GNOME. And I love Focus Follows Mouse. Jeff also emailed in about Enlightenment.
You guys asked about Enlightenment and who uses it. Well, at one point in time, it was my primary DE and might be again with this new release once I test it. It's blazing fast and smooth on just about any hardware, even with software compositing. It also laughs at Plasma's configurability. Enlightenment can be tweaked far beyond the point of breakage, and I love it. Its biggest killer feature is that if you're using multiple monitors, each monitor gets its own virtual displays. No other DE I've found can do this, and I don't know why. I can't wait to try this release out. Thanks for sharing.
Each monitor gets its own virtual displays. Does that mean if you are looking at a particular monitor, you can switch desktop, but all the others stay where they are?
but only on that. Yeah, exactly. Only on that screen.
Huh. Because the default on GNOME is only the primary one changes. So if you go down, then all the other displays stay static and the only the primary one moves, which is, I don't understand why they did that, but so I've changed it. So it actually moves all of them.
When I used to use virtual desktops, I would have really liked that as a thing. So I ended up, what I would often do was I would have one screen where I would have the window on that was set to display on all desktops. So when I switched desktops on the other one, that one stayed there. Yeah, but I have to say, hearing all of these words about enlightenment does kind of make me want to try it now. Next up, Torin Doyle posted a comment on our website.
I like Alan's idea of GNU Imp, although I like the name GIMP. I can see those less IT savvy people, how they see it as an odd name. I don't know, Imp. You don't have to use the GNU part. You could just call it Imp, I guess. But it's a bit short, isn't it? I don't know. Well, it's largely irrelevant because GIMP are keeping their name GIMP and Glimpse have got their name. Anyway, Yui Showercamp emailed us.
Isn't Imp a derogatory term as well, though? I don't think calling it GNU Imp would help much if I recall my Games of Thrones knowledge correctly.
Well, this is where my knowledge falls apart because I've never watched a single frame of Game of Thrones or whatever it's called.
I think Imp is not, you know, exclusively derogatory. It can be playful as well, and it's a fantasy creature thing. And, well, yeah, it doesn't have the same connotations that GIMP does, certainly.
Maybe they should call it GNU Orc, but then all the orcs would get grumpy then, wouldn't they? So you can't please everyone.
And that's all your feedback for this week. And that's all for episode 24. Next week, we will have our usual roundup of community news, goings-on and events. Hopefully, Martin will be back from New York and we can ask what was going on there.
He'll also have been to Paris with me in between.
Oh, well, we'll hear about that as well.
Yeah. Yes, you will.
Excellent. well, until next time then, have a good couple of weeks. Bye-bye.